the president hailing it as a substantial phase one deal, a first part of a potential three-phase deal that he says delivers on all of his trade promises with China.
Federal Reserve just announced about 10 minutes ago that it will begin short-term treasury bill operations and will be purchasing at a $60 billion per month rate. That will be going through the second quarter of next year.
And good news for anyone on Social Security right now, benefits will be increasing next year. Nearly 69 million Americans will see a 1.6% increase in their Social Security benefits.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, finally, we got some good news on the trade front. A preliminary trade agreement was reached between China and the U.S. on Friday. The market's reacting favorably. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up, Ari Wald will be joining us. He's saying we still are in a favorable bull market. You're going to want to hear about what he thinks is an upcoming rotation and what could be an explosive rally. Also later on in the program from Moody's Analytics, Ryan Sweet will be joining us. We're going to take a look at some of those ISM numbers, especially on the manufacturing side. He says you got to look at the soft data. It's the soft data, which is sentiment, which is really what is not looking good. If you look at the hard data, it actually looks much better. And of course, we'll be discussing the trade deal on the big picture, and Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up on today's program.
Lots of important things happening, affecting the market. Ryan Poplava, I'm interested in hearing your analysis of all of this. So let's welcome Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Chris. You know, let's talk trade because that's all the market really cared about this week. Very much a teeter-totter action throughout the week, especially even on Friday when we got those final results of the trade. There was a lot of trade hawkish comments from the Chinese, and there was a visa and blacklisting of Chinese officials by the U.S. that concerned investors that a trade deal would be damaged through the release of that. And then there was the subsequent hope and comments from Kudlow to Trump on Friday that lifted spirits. And, you know, the Federal Reserve minutes were released on Wednesday, and that didn't change the monetary message that came out last month, except interest was kind of peaked on a portion of the notes that said a few participants commented on the possibility of resuming asset purchases, essentially to stabilize the level of reserves in the banking system. So recall the week of the last Fed meeting, a couple of weeks ago, now or three, I forget, that the New York Fed flushed the market with daily repo operations of about $75 billion each until it culminated in just this Thursday. And then there was three 14-day term repo operations for about $30 billion each. So the Fed was flushing the market with cash with some major issues we haven't seen in years in that side of the market. And Powell this week took things a step further. He said, organic balance sheet expansion will resume soon, meaning I believe that he will reinvest maturities as well as maybe invest interest from their bond positions, which they used to do. So in addition, Powell didn't talk down the possibility of a rate cut later this month. He still continues to focus on that trade is a headwind and is an uncertainty. We've seen inflation very low. The CPI number came out this week and no one was even talking about it because everyone was just concerned about trade, but it was low. You know, Powell didn't talk the possibility of a rate cut this month, so futures remain elevated, but down on Friday as a result of the trade optimism, and that came into around 69% probability right now.
Now, Ryan, if trade was the primary catalyst for movements in the market, let's recap on some of the headlines, because I imagine a lot of folks are wondering, you know, how does Financial Sense factor all this in? How are you guys positioning portfolios in the midst of this kind of a teeter-totter week?
Well, let me answer that directly, and then let's take a look at those catalysts. You know, we're neutrally positioned as we've been following the market. It's been consolidating now for about a month or so, and it's hard to trade a 65 or an 80-year-old's portfolio on tweets and headlines. You know, we can't do that. So we position our clients in what's suitable for them. But right now, our own equity position, we're very neutral in whatever objective our clients have, whether they're 60% equities or they're 30% equities, that's where we're at. And we're not going above that right now or going below that until we see more clarity and see the market have a reaction to that clarity. We will have to see how things kind of play out because we did pare back towards the end of the day on Friday. But all right, so let's take a look at those trade catalysts. So we know that the big players were meeting at the end of the week, but the headline started on Monday. And the market shot up on the first headline from China's Commerce Ministry, who said they were ready to do a deal on parts of the negotiations both sides agreed on. And with the intention to work out harder issues, they said, for next year, let's work out some of those other things we can agree on. So let's agree on what we can, work on what we can't next year. But the market took a bad spell soon after when the same commentary came out from the Chinese Commerce Ministry saying that changes to their laws on intellectual property are not on the table and never will be. But to a lesser degree, he said that they could manage these issues through administrative regulations. So obviously they're respecting their sovereignty right there. We would do the same, right? If the Chinese wanted us to change our laws, I don't think we'd say, oh yeah, sure. No problem. The following day on Tuesday, maybe not the best timing, the U.S. Department of Commerce named 19 Chinese governmental and agencies and about 8 commercial firms to its entity list due to their part in fostering human rights violations against Muslim ethnic minorities in China. They also implemented a visa ban for Chinese officials linked to human rights abuses in Xinjiang. So the market sold off on this news, and that was for fear that the blacklisting would damage goodwill, possibly see the Chinese walk away. But we rallied soon after as there was a Bloomberg News report on Wednesday that China was still open to trade talks despite this situation with the blacklisting and the visa bans. And then there was a Bloomberg report Tuesday that said there's interest from the Chinese in agricultural purchases. Essentially, they're saying, okay, we'll buy agricultural purchases. You guys stop the increases in tariffs. So Thursday, Trump came to the rescue to feed the rally flame on trade with a tweet suggesting he would meet Friday with Vice Premier Hu. That didn't give away any reasons there would be a deal, but it did stem the fear that the Chinese would leave early, having maybe been upset over the bannings and the blacklisting. And then Trump again tweeted on Friday with more encouragement that morning, saying good things are happening at China trade talk meeting, warmer feelings than in recent past, more like the old days. So, that's what so far what has caused the market to rally Friday.
I hate if I can just pipe in here. It looks like news has just broken while we're recording that phase one of a deal actually was agreed upon.
Oh, wow.
By the Chinese and the U.S. So
thought maybe we'd hear that late in the evening on Friday, but
I was thinking so too. So, we might as well go over a couple bullet points here that are breaking news. Trump says that there is an agreement on currency, apparently an agreement that China is not a currency manipulator. And then there's some developments on foreign exchange issues, progress on technology transfer. That's actually phase two, a phase two focus, and that there might be a phase three. So this is really moving in the right direction. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin says no tariff hike on October 15th. It's highlighting agreements on financial services and foreign exchange. And Vice Premier Liu He says there has been a lot of progress. So, wow, that is really moving things into a different direction.
Well, the question now, Chris, is, do we get more details on the agreement? Will the market sell off on that news? Is it underwhelmed from what's taken place here? And we'll just have to continue to watch and see how the market reacts. As we're looking here, we are coming back from the highs now as the market heads towards its close. So, that's very interesting. And, I'm glad that there's at least some progress here. We've been wanting to see progress for at least a year. So this is a good deal. It's at least the start of hopefully more to come. There's one more headline, Chris, I wanted to mention this week because there could be possibly some broad reach at this time from it. But looking at the international shipbroking firm Clarkson Plateau Research, they reported the largest week-on-week increase in the history of their freight index. So we're talking about freight shipping and mainly, I think, in oil. And they said that the Suezmax rates jumped 60% from Thursday to Friday last week and 400% on the month. Now, the report I read said that there was already a seasonal upturn happening due to an increase in demand at refineries around the world, increasing production to supply of low sulfur fuels for 2020 combined, with fewer supply of new vessels as a factor. There's fewer vessels. You know, there's a lot of issues right now with, I think, the scrubbers that they're having to put on, and on top of maybe just supply, they're saying here. So tankers have been on just fire since last Thursday, and now we know why.
So just to recap for our listeners, no tariff increase next week. That's a small but significant win. And, you know, this part of our program of the Financial Sense News Hour is my personal favorite in encapsulating all of the events of the week in just a handful of minutes. But still with that, you may have a question about what's said, maybe even a takeaway that has struck you in either agreement or disagreement. And either way, we'd like to hear from you on this. And you can reach us at our Q line number. It is 1-833-ASK-FSN for Financial Sense News Hour. That number again is 1-833-ASK-FSN. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
We're trying to find, where do people fail when they trade? And then we're trying to say, okay, where do computers fail when they trade? And create a system that negates those, right? So as you were talking about, humans generally fail when they trade, when their emotions get too hot or when they think they know something. You hear it all the time, the guy who's figured it out, and then you fast forward 6 months and he unfortunately blew up his account. And then you hear the opposite all the time, where people are 100% reliant on a computerized system and it works for a while and then that blows up. So generally what happens when a human blows up is emotional. And generally what happens when a computer system doesn't do well, it's contextual. It's understanding things like the outside environment, right? We're feeding these massive amount of machine learning data, and it's running millions and millions of simulations every night with, you know, thousands of filter sets that Trade Ideas has built over the 10 years that they've been around. But at the same time, it doesn't know things like the Brexit or the presidential election. So what we're trying to do when we're teaching it, like David said, is that if all of a sudden the next day looks absolutely nothing like you thought it would, it's time to sit out.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the market continues to trussle back and forth between various headlines, tweets, and front page news. Where is it going in the future as we head into the autumn and this fall, with typically a period of time of turbulence in the market? Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer is Ari Wald. Ari, let's talk about where the market is today. And, you know, looking back over the last 12 months, we had that steep sell-off last fall and winter, taking the markets down. This year, we've regained it back, but it almost looks like we've gone nowhere in 12 months.
Hey, Jim, that's right. I think that's a great summary of how the market has traded over the last 12-plus months, and kind of how we would characterize it is that risk in general has really been in a almost coming up to a two-year decline dating back to January of 2018. That's more or less when global markets peaked the world over. I think 2018 was then characterized by slowly those markets cracking and starting to turn lower. And it was concluded at the end of the year, that very sharp climactic low in December is a small bear market. You know, at that point, a lot of our criteria for a bear market, albeit a small one, was reached. More recently in 2019, we've seen a lot of these equity markets building a base, trying to push higher, but not definitively yet. And here the S&P 500, a few percentage points away from an all-time high that it was that it set in July, but still more or less flat looking back at the last 12 months, kind of more or less where it was trading at in September, October of 2018. So our reasons for being bullish here is more for the expectation of mean reversion, that after following such an extended period of little market progress, we expect stronger returns looking ahead. You know, if we think of the S&P 500's 12-month rate of change as an oscillator, market only up 2% over the last year. It's hovered around 0% for much of 2019. This looks very similar to the resets in 2011 and 2016. And as I think risk securities in general start to build this base and start to incrementally inflect higher, we think 2020 is going to be a better year for the market.
So, Ari, reflecting this peak in risk assets going back 2 years, this is reflected, at least in my opinion, what we're seeing in market sectors. You're seeing REITs, utilities, consumer staples outperforming all the other sectors, with maybe one exception. Technology still looks pretty good within that sector. If we are building a base and we are going to be shifting and you expect the market to go higher, would you expect a change in leadership? In other words, staples, utilities, and REITs are sold off and money flows into other sectors?
Yes, we would. And when we talk about these sector rotations, really a key driver has been interest rates, that as interest rates and the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield in particular over the course of the last year has gone from over 3% to now 1.5%, we've seen a lot of those high dividend paying sectors like staples, like REITs, like utilities outperform. Now, as interest rates, and that's another great proxy for how extended safety has become, the 2-year bear market just looking at the direction of interest rates over the last 2 years. I think we're at a point where interest rates are now starting to stabilize. We have a 10-year treasury yield trying to make a higher low at 1.5%. Again, this is near the level where the 10-year stabilized in 2016 and that 2012 period as well. And I think as that stabilization takes place in interest rates, you should start to see leadership by more cyclical sectors. That in general, that if we think of kind of relative ratios, you know, one popular, one high beta versus low volatility, it's a great proxy for kind of cyclicals versus non-cyclicals. It's been very tightly correlated to the 10-year. So if we're right, and this should be, and we're at a point where cyclicals could make a recovery here, and we see some rotation, I think it starts with the 10-year. And at that point, and as the 10-year starts to move higher, you should start to see some better returns in the more cyclical sectors and out of the defensives. I think as, in regards to tech, as much as it's done well through this decline in interest rates, is we've also seen points where technology has outperformed when rates back higher as well, that it's shown more of a zero correlation to interest rates. So for that reason, I don't think technology necessarily underperforms, but I think you'll start to see the more cyclical parts of tech maybe start to do better, like semiconductors showing really brilliant relative strength against these on-off trade war headlines, holding up quite well in recent months and starting to turn higher.
And let's talk about, so you think the market is basing. Let's talk about where we are right now. Typically, September, October tend to be very turbulent months. And you know, I'm just thinking of last year at the beginning of October, we began that descent that culminated on December 24th, where the market, as you said, It was almost like a mini bear market. We were down close to 20%. What is it about this time of the year, Ari? It seems like every single year, September, October, they're turbulent for whatever reason. I've never had a good explanation why that is.
You're right, whether it's the lack of trading in the summer months that extends into September, October. The reason isn't, I'm unsure about the reason myself. Some would say that there's an earnings cycle that tends to corroborate that a little bit. But what is interesting that the market has tracked it pretty closely in 2019. You usually get a little bit of a seasonal top first in July. We had a top in the market in July. You tend to have another one in September. We had a little bit of a mini top in September as well. And then you start to see conditions improve come the middle to late October, and ahead of stronger returns in November, December. We didn't get that last year. I think that was where we didn't quite follow the roadmap was in 2019 when we just continued to decline lower. But I think that's going to be different about 2019, that I do think we are set up for what is typically that late Q4, November, December rally, the way things are setting up in our work.
Well, the one thing that we have going for us now that we didn't have last year, the Fed was pretty hawkish last year, beginning with its September statement that they were nowhere close to neutral. Then they were saying QT was on automatic pilot in December, which sent the markets reeling. At least now we're in the opposite direction. They're providing liquidity in the market, especially the repo market. So at least it seems like a major headwind for the market has been removed.
That case can be made that the initial Fed action in December caused some of was a catalyst for some of that selling. I think what's a bit what we have to differentiate here is that, you know, the Fed really is the key driver of the economic cycle. And of course, the equity cycle and the economy cycle, they do play into each other, but we're at very different points of it. We've had these very traditional, how I would see it, equity cycles in recent years. We had a bear market, small non-recessionary bear market in the 2015-2016 period, a new bull cycle in 2017-18. We had another small bear market in 2018, and I think we're now setting up for another new bull cycle that started this year and into 2020. At the same time, we've been in the same economic cycle since 2009. So this is all occurring within these maturing late economic cycle conditions. And as the Fed, they were tightening interest rates up until late 2018, it caused this flattening in the yield curve and then inversion in the yield curve more recently. Of late, given more dovish policy, we've seen a little bit of steepening. But I think that does, nonetheless, the inversion that we had in August, speaking specifically between the spread between the 2 and 10 year U.S. Treasury yield, I think it does suggest that the economic clock is ticking. If you look back historically, it tends to mark the end of an economic cycle, but it's a very poor timing signal in terms of a market top. That from the point you get the inversion in the yield curve to the peak in the S&P 500, it could typically lead it between 18 to 20 months, somewhere around a year and a half. And through that, you can have a 20-25% move in the equity market. I think that's what we're setting up for, this kind of one final move higher, possibly into the 2020 U.S. election. But that could be marking peak economy at that point, the way we're setting up with Fed policy and the yield curve.
So basically, if I understand you correctly, you're saying we're setting ourselves up for the grand finale, is because most bear markets don't begin when everybody's negative or sentiment is negative as it is today.
That's a great point, is that I think a lot of the bad news has already been priced in, and I think we've already endured what was a very difficult year, 18, 24 months in the market, that we've already had the ISM manufacturing PMI dip below 50. If you look back historically, that tends to be followed by actually higher S&P returns. And so while it could just be setting up this kind of one final move higher here after we've already kind of baked in some of this bad news, I think even as we think about the next recession, we shouldn't be thinking about it in terms of 2001 and 2008. that, you know, yes, the economy cycles, there will be recessions, but really the outliers were those very deep downturns that we had in the last decade. We should be thinking about recessions more similar to the ones that we had in the 80s and 1990s and even the 1950s and 1960s. And then thinking in terms of how the equity market is going to respond, because I do think that we are in this larger secular bull market that we might only be halfway through in terms of the S&P 500.
All right. I want to turn our attention to another market. If we are setting ourselves up for the grand finale, maybe we get a bump in the economy. Let's talk about commodities. Specifically, I want to talk about what's going on with gold, oil, and copper.
All right. Well, gold is really trading less how we see it. It's trading more as in line with interest rates rather than commodities. Thinking about commodities as a whole and thinking in terms of the equal weighted commodity index, we think we are in a secular non-bull market. What does that mean? We think we're in a very large trading range for commodity markets. Historically, that's how commodities trade as well. If you look back through periods like the 1950s and the 1960s and 80s and 90s, you had these big, rally, boom, bust cycles in commodity prices, but they more or less traded in more in a directionless fashion. They didn't just really trend higher. And thinking in terms of the response from equities, those were very good environments for stock markets. And I think that's what we're in. What do stocks like? High commodities, low commodities? No, stable commodities. And I think that's exactly what we have here. I think it's the catalyst for this secular bull market. I think it's going to be driven by the U.S. dollar. But what's going on underneath the surface? Gold has had a terrific run through this. I think if you overlay gold with interest rates, gold is trading more as a safe haven asset. As interest rates have gone lower, gold has moved higher. It's the only commodity that's really been able to rally in this environment. So I think one's view on interest rates should be in line with one's view on the price of gold. We think it's had a terrific run. We think if we're of the view that interest rates are possibly bottoming here, we also think that gold could possibly be topping here. Now, gold did come out of a massive five-year base. There's good support below it. But I think a lot of, unless you're making the case for negative interest rates, I think a lot of that run in gold is over. Oil and copper, on the other hand, kind of more emblematic of that trading range that we spoke about. And really just, I think it's just that, just a trading range. I don't think that those are necessarily attractive assets to be in at this point. Near-term oversold could be set up for a bounce, but just don't see the upside either. Again, good for the stock market, less so for those stocks tied to commodity prices. And I think that's why we've seen this big trends of relative underperformance by sectors like energy and materials.
So, Ari, given the fact that you think the grand finale lies directly ahead of us, maybe not this year, maybe this plays out in 2020 ahead of the election, as an investor, if you're in stocks, what would you tell people to do? If you've been sitting on the sidelines with cash, what would you be doing?
Yeah, grand finale wouldn't be the words and terms that we'd use. We kind of think of it that, we should be setting up for another new bull market in 2020 and what could just be the middle stages of this larger secular bull market. So, our advice would be to get into the stock market. I think this is a good market environment to be in stocks. So we'd be putting to use in ideas like semiconductors and home builders, selectively within capital goods and security exchanges. I think there's still money to be made in this market, and I think the cash would be better used in security prices.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. You have yourself a great weekend and hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Jim. You as well. It's always a pleasure.
Our
Premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I mean, there is a lot of uncertainty here, and when things are slowing, you certainly have to be on the lookout to see how much of a weakening is underway. And of course, there's the ongoing question of how much of a drag on the economy there will be from the trade war and all the associated uncertainty. There's another round of trade negotiations, certainly trade talks in Washington this week between the U.S. and China. So that's a big factor in the background. And certainly it's not that hard to come up with a scenario where trade tensions keep escalating, that raises uncertainty, that undermines confidence. And I mean, the weakness does accumulate and feed on itself enough that you could get a recession in the next year.
If you've been watching the economic data lately, it's been somewhat confusing. If not, some of it is looking like the U.S. could be heading into a recession, depending on what you're looking at. At the same time, we have other data like the unemployment report hitting 3.5%. Things are looking pretty good. Which way is it? Joining us on the program is Ryan Sweet from Moody's Analytics. Ryan, I want to begin with two ISM numbers. The ISM manufacturing number, which has gone below 50 2 months in a row, indicating that manufacturing is contracting. Then if you look at the ISM service numbers, they're still above 50, and it looks like the economy is expanding. So let's get into the weeds somewhat, and let's begin with the ISM. Are we at risk of a manufacturing recession?
Well, I think manufacturing is most likely already in a recession, and there's a few reasons behind that. Manufacturing's hit a little bit of troubled water because of the trade tensions, which have escalated over the last few months, a slowing global economy, and we have a little bit of a, you know, inventory correction going on in the U.S. And throw on top of that past appreciation in the U.S. dollar. So that's a lot for manufacturing to digest. And I think you're seeing some weakness in manufacturing. Now, manufacturing makes up about 10% of GDP, 9% of employment. And we've had manufacturing recessions during this current economic expansion. So the fact that manufacturing is struggling, even though it's important to the economy, it's not the entire U.S. economy. Therefore, this expansion could go on without manufacturing contributing much.
Okay, so now let's look at the service side, which is still above 50, and looks like service is doing pretty well.
It is, and there's I think the job market has a lot to do with that. The job market in the U.S. is pretty tight. Wage growth is picking up. Consumer confidence is still pretty strong. And that's all being very supportive to services. And now services include retail, construction, and in the ISM non-manufacturing survey, mining as well. So construction is clearly benefiting from the recent drop in mortgage rates, which has led to an increase in new home sales. Housing starts are improving. Permits are picking up. So housing has actually improved over the last 3-6 months. And normally you don't see that ahead of an economic recession. Usually housing starts, housing permits are falling 6 to 9 months ahead of a recession. And the opposite is this time around.
I want to talk about recently the IMF and the World Bank have lowered once again their global economic growth rates for 2019 and in 2020. How much of that is really having its greatest impact on manufacturing, as you said, which could already be in a recession?
Well, I think the IMF forecasts are just, you know, reflecting the incoming data, the recent escalation in the trade tensions between the U.S. and China. And that's really, weighing on the collective psyche. And I think the one thing to keep in mind when looking at the ISM manufacturing survey is that there's a confidence component to this. And we can back out the hard versus the soft ISM survey, doing it econometrically. So you can map the components of the ISM manufacturing survey to the hard data on manufacturing. So manufacturing employment, manufacturing inventories, manufacturing supplier deliveries. And then you can, look at the sentiment component. And that's really what's been pulling the ISM manufacturing survey lower. And I think that's just a reflection of these trade tensions. And you can't read a news story about the economy, turn on the TV without hearing about these trade tensions. And I think they're beginning to really have an impact on manufacturer supplier deliveries, but also manufacturers' confidence because there's no end in sight to these trade tensions.
And how much of this is having an impact? We've seen weakness in business investment. I mean, if I'm looking at a global trade war, I'm a multinational company, probably not likely to invest a lot of money when there's this kind of uncertainty. And then if you want to throw another uncertainty, now we have the impeachment uncertainty. So how much is it a confluence of those adding up together? And what impact is that having on business investment?
Well, I think it's having a clear negative impact. Uncertainty, businesses, they don't like uncertainty. And throughout this expansion, we've had numerous periods where uncertainty would spike. You had the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. You had uncertainty surrounding the 2016 presidential election. And now we have a lot of trade policy uncertainty. And I do think businesses are responding to this uncertainty. You know, they're cutting back on investment because they're trying to figure out, are these tariffs in place, you know, for the foreseeable future, or are these tariffs going to be rolled back at some point? And when businesses have more questions than answers, typically they pull back on investing in things like equipment, software, structures. The good news is this uncertainty hasn't led them to begin laying off workers. Now, if that were to occur, that's fodder for a recession. If the unemployment rate starts to rise, even from a very low level of 3.5%, that will set us up for an economic downturn. Because when unemployment increases, consumers take notice, so you and I will adjust our spending behavior. We start to get really worried. We could be possibly laid off. So as consumers, we really begin to hunker down in if unemployment starts to rise. So the good news there is there's very little indication that businesses are laying off workers. Jobless claims are low. The unemployment rate is at 3.5%. But going forward, that's going to be crucial to keep a close eye on.
I want to stay on this trade war for a minute. How much of this is going to be reflected in, let's say, redirecting supply chains? If, we've seen this tension with China go on for 2 years, at least with this president. It looks like who knows what will be solved this week, if anything. If you were a business, I've read some stories, the Wall Street Journal has reported, some companies are saying, we're going to set up a factory in Vietnam or Thailand or someplace else. How much of that is changing right now? In other words, redirecting the global supply chain?
I think a lot's been going on. And I think that's, one of the potential long-term or medium-term risks of these trade tensions is that it's going to permanently alter the global supply chain. And when you disrupt the global supply chain, that has a pretty serious knock-on effects. In the U.S., I think, one of the goals of, using tariffs against China was in hopes that we'd bring back more manufacturing jobs. That wasn't ever going to happen. Now, some jobs could come back, but for the most part, the infrastructure, the capital stock of U.S. manufacturing, the structures, it's pretty old. We don't have the infrastructure here to bring back a lot of these manufacturing jobs. And also the comparative advantages, for the U.S. is particularly with wages is not in favor of reshoring a lot of these manufacturing jobs. So that's why you're seeing the shifting of the supply chains from China, maybe to Vietnam, South Korea, Thailand. They're finding other places, other low-cost alternatives to, manufacture their goods and then importing them. And if you look at the trade deficit, it's pretty clear that's what's happening. The trade deficit with China has narrowed, but the deficit with the rest of the world is widened by almost the same amount that it's narrowed with China. So we're just, moving the parts around and it's not having any noticeable impact on the overall trade deficit in the U.S.
When you're looking at sentiment and soft data, how long before it really starts to have an impact? In other words, as you mentioned, you can't turn on the television every single day, especially this week with China coming to Washington. You're hearing trade data, but also with some of the weaker ISM numbers, as we pointed out, a lot of that having to do with sentiment. Ryan, you also have financial stations now talking about recession. I mean, a year ago, you never heard the R word, or it was very seldom. Today, you're hearing it more frequently. How long before it starts to impact consumers? I mean, I walked into Costco 2 weeks ago and they had Christmas decorations up already.
Yeah, I noticed the same thing. I went into Lowe's and they had Christmas trees up in late September. We haven't gotten through Halloween or Thanksgiving yet. And, we're already thinking about the holidays. Confidence is important inflection points for the U.S. economy. Most of the business cycle, confidence just normally reflects current economic conditions. So when the economy is doing well, people are more optimistic, they're more confident, same with businesses. But at turning points, confidence can, be very, very important because this whole idea of, you know, animal spirits. You know, if the collective psyche starts to fray, you know, businesses cut back further on investment, they start laying off workers, consumers then begin to respond by cutting back on spending, and that leads to more layoffs, and you get this, you know, vicious circle that is difficult to break. So far, most of the decline in confidence is business confidence. And I think that's a lot of that you can just pinpoint back to these trade tensions and trade uncertainty. But also you have Brexit. There's a lot of things that are just hanging over businesses' heads. The consumer, on the other hand, confidence is still holding up pretty strong. Now, if that starts to decline, you know, steadily over 3, 4, or 5 months, then that would be a cause for concern, because confidence is a coincident indicator. And eventually that could begin to feed into spending habits. But again, the key thing to remember is the relationship between consumer confidence and spending is pretty loose in the short term. But over time, if confidence is trending lower, then eventually, you know, I think the consumer will start to tighten the purse strings. And then that would become fodder for an economic downturn.
Let's talk about two other elements that are associated with recession. One is a Fed rate raising cycle. And last year, they were pretty aggressive. They raised rates 4 times, but then did a complete 180. They've already cut interest rates twice. How much is that contributing to, let's say, making this expansion a little bit more durable than in past expansions? Because they've already flipped in lowering rates. Unemployment is low, and it looks like we're still growing at close to 2%.
Yeah, I can understand why people are talking about a recession, because this is the longest expansion on record in the U.S. And people just assume that expansions have to die of old age. And economists famously, you know, like to say that something kills expansions; they don't have to die of old age. And if you look at the last 100 years, most of the traditional causes of a recession, an overheating economy, the Fed raising interest rates too aggressively, oil price shocks, asset bubbles, none of them seem overly threatening right now. If there were to be a recession in the next 12 months, it would most likely be because of further escalation in the trade tensions between the U.S. and China. So it would be a policy error. I'm not view that we're barreling towards a recession. Now, a recession will happen at some point. We haven't repealed the business cycle, but I don't think a recession in 2020 is necessarily a slam dunk. The general consensus among economists is, you know, odds are pretty high that 2020 would be a recession, and economists' track record in forecasting recessions is pretty spotty. So the fact that a lot of economists are saying 2020 is when the recession is going to happen means it won't be in 2020. Really, for a recession to occur next year, something has to happen now that really affects the collective psyche and has significant economic costs. It may not be one thing; it could be a combination of things. So, you know, October is a little bit scary because we have Brexit, we have trade talks between the U.S. and China, and if both of those go poorly, then, you know, that could be enough to really affect the collective psyche, affect financial markets, and then eventually feed into the economy. But I'm pretty optimistic that we'll get through, you know, 2020 without an economic without a recession.
And then the final one, which has been raised, and this is one of the reasons you see some of the financial channels talking about a recession, and that is the inverted yield curve. But as you and I have discussed in past interviews, Ryan, I think you can't rely on that as much as you have in the past, because you have so much interference with this quantitative easing. I mean, we have, what, $14 trillion of negative debt in Europe and in Asia. So I don't see that as a reliable predictor as it once was.
No, I agree with you. Unfortunately, you and I seem to be on an island by ourselves. I mean, there's a few other people that are arguing, making the same case that the yield curve is sending a misleading signal. But the general consensus is, you know, the yield curve is still indicating a recession is coming in the next 12 months. When I look at the yield curve, it's the 10-year minus the 3-month. You know, that's the best recession indicator, and that inverted back in March. And if history is any guide, it's usually 12, 13 months between the first inversion of the yield curve and a recession. So that would apply early 2020. But the thing I take away from the yield curve is that there's a message there that, you know, the bond market's worried, you know, about the economy. But I don't think the recession signal is as strong as in the past, because, as you alluded to, quantitative easing, you have negative interest rates, you know, in other parts of the world, and that's affecting, you know, that's pulling long-term rates down in the U.S. So the 10-year treasury yield is really no longer a true risk-free rate. And I think that is distorting the message coming from the yield curve.
Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the services at Moody's, you guys cover a broad spectrum of indicators, not only here in the U.S., but also globally. How could they find out more information about your firm?
You can go to economy.com, and that's our real-time economic web service, and we cover 300 economic indicators. We have daily research notes about the economy, about financial market conditions, and as you can imagine, we're talking a lot about, you know, the prospects of a recession.
All right. Well, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. All the best, sir. Come back again.
Thank you again for having me.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered. No matter what direction the markets take, we can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
It's been a really interesting week for stocks, for the market, a lot of hopes resting on U.S.-China trade talks. We also see a lot going on with people talking about Brexit, concern about impeachment. We want to welcome Chris Poplava to the studio where we'll discuss all of this. Chris, what do you see happening with the markets right now? There's a lot going on, as I mentioned, and even with what's happening with Turkey and the Kurds, where do you see things standing in the market?
Right now, I think there's a lot of asymmetry in the market in terms of what could happen. What I mean by that is, I think if you look at where the money has gone in the markets and where it's left, there's been a lot, I'm talking hundreds of billions of dollars this year that has gone into bond funds, even into money markets. So I think investors are positioned for the bearish outcome. And so that's why even if we don't exactly get a good trade deal, I think the downside could be somewhat limited because I think everyone's already positioned for that. Now, on the flip side, if we do get some positive trade deals with China and the U.S. today, then I think we could see the market actually rally pretty strongly. And I say that because I think there's a lot of managers that are underweight equities. And I say that because of where the positioning has been in terms of flows into ETFs and mutual funds. It's been on the defensive side. It's in defensive equities like minimum volatility equities, utilities. It's also into bonds and it's also into money markets. And so that's why if we do get a trade deal, I would not be surprised to see markets hit all-time highs. And in particular, I think the defensive plays might see a little bit of a sell-off because that's where the money is gravitated towards and more of a stronger move into the higher risk areas like small cap stocks, cyclical stocks like industrials, financials, and so forth. So I think there's a lot riding on what's going to happen today in terms of that final outcome of the trade negotiations. And I think if we do see some positive developments, I do think we could be set for new highs in the market.
Well, that's interesting, Chris, because we are seeing gains for major U.S. indexes that came alongside a rise in global stocks and bond yields. But are investors concerned about impeachment talk? Because one thing we know that the market hates is uncertainty. I would think that this impeachment process is synonymous with uncertainty. Is that a big problem?
I think the uncertainty, probably the biggest uncertainty right now is not the impeachment process. I think that will be a lot of back and forth. I mean, we saw the, how long the Russian investigation played out. But I think what's the biggest uncertainty is not in the U.S., it's global. And the biggest global uncertainty is the trade war with China and the U.S. You know, the politics in the U.S. and the uncertainty with the impeachment, you know, that's more domestic focused and that's going to impact more of the U.S. markets and economy. But I think what's going to impact the world is what happens between the U.S. and China with this trade deal. You've got companies all over the world who don't know how to spend their money. They don't know if they can put money on capital expenditures, on projects, if they can make deals in China. And just as an example of that, we have a client who is directly being impacted by the tariffs coming from placed on China, and they're considering having to move their manufacturing back to the U.S. But that by doing that, that would absolutely actually kill their margins. And so they would be suffering. You might have to lay people off. So the trade implications and the trade deal is, it's incredibly significant. And I think it would be the biggest uncertainty globally, even more so than the Brexit and U.S. Impeachment process.
That's interesting because John Porter, Chief Investment Officer at Mellon Investments, said, and I quote, "When I see a conclusive agreement in place with China, then I'll react to the details," end quote. In the past, Chris, we've noticed that when we expect something good to happen on a trade deal with China, sometimes all bets are off, it goes the opposite direction, and the markets go sideways. Is there any indication that this really could be progress with a trade deal?
I don't think so. If anything, I think this is a cessation in the escalation of the trade war. And, you know, we have the tariffs are supposed to go into place next week, where tariffs will be increased by another 5% on Chinese goods. I don't think we're going to have substantial progress, especially if you saw some of the news releases that came out prior to the meeting in terms of intellectual property not really being on the table. So there's going to be ongoing problems with China, and this isn't going to go away. And I think the real big thing is that it's not going to be further escalated, that we might even be dialing down some of the increases in the tariffs. So this is going to be with us to stay. And that's why I think even if we do get a trade deal, there's still going to be some uncertainty. It'll just be dialed back a little bit. And that will create some relief, I think, in the markets and the economy.
Do you see a lot of American companies showing real concern about what's happening, for example, with Hong Kong? I ask because Apple removed an app that protesters in Hong Kong were using to find out where police were. Now, we also know that China accounts for about 20% of Apple's business. So we understand from a business sense why American companies might react. But do you think that this issue of free speech, are we going to see, Chris, more American companies start to sort of bend or bow to China? Or do you think free speech will reign?
You know, I think, you know, for a lot of companies, it's the bottom line. You know, they're responsible to shareholders. Shareholders are the ones that are ultimately their clients. They're the ones that they're going to have to answer to, you know, every quarter when they're releasing their results. So I think it's a real sticky situation. I think for companies in general, I think they're going to try to, as much as possible, you know, stay out of it, stay neutral, unless they're kind of brought into the limelight from some news article that kind of highlights their involvement. But I think they're going to try to at least stay out of it as much as possible, because then there would be obviously some potential business risk where they could really get hurt with their business.
Well, I want to move on to talking about what happened with the Iranian tanker near the Saudi Arabian coast. Now, it suffered damage on Friday, and the ship's owner is suggesting that it may have been a missile attack. Now, Brent crude oil jumped over 2%, seemingly based on that, and the alleged missile strike, it couldn't be independently verified. And in fact, Iran's oil ministry later said that there was no fire. But this speaks to more and more concern about the vulnerability of some of these Saudi oil facilities. Chris, where do you see oil in such a vulnerable environment?
I think oil right now is staying range bound because we do have a global economy that is slowing. So that's on the demand side of the equation. And I don't see the demand side, you know, really picking up materially unless we get a very substantial trade deal or we get some kind of significant stimulus coming from the U.S. Fed, where the U.S. Fed either cuts interest rates further, they expand their balance sheet to help, you know, increase reserves in the system in such a way that would weaken the dollar, which would be bullish for global growth and the reflationary trade. But, you know, so that's more on the demand side. The supply side, it could be sense of a geopolitics and in terms of that premium that can be embedded in oil. I will say with the global economy showing the weakest growth in nearly a decade, this is not the time that we want to see rising geopolitical risk embedded in the price of oil. You know, I don't think the global economy, even the U.S. economy, could really handle a significant shock in oil prices. So from that standpoint, I do think it's something to keep an eye on in case we do see a spike in oil in a very vulnerable time economically. But overall, if we see some least pause and no further escalation in tensions there, then I think the global economy will be okay. But it is something certainly to keep an eye on.
Well, Chris, in wrapping up, a lot of folks are talking about just how consequential a trade deal can be for the U.S. economy. Chris, can you speak to that? I mean, just what would this mean to our economy?
I definitely think if you look at the U.S. economy, we're in, and it's very clear, and this is a fact, that we are in a manufacturing recession. And that's not a big deal, as we had one back in 2015-16, but that didn't lead to a widespread official recession here in the U.S., given that we're more of a service-based economy and manufacturing somewhere around, I think, 10-11% of the economy. So what it will do, though, is, you know, manufacturing is the more volatile part of the economy. It's the more cyclical part. And we're definitely in recession, and the concern right now is that could spill over into the service economy. And so that's why I think having a trade deal, or at least some improvement on that front, is so important to make sure that the weakness in manufacturing does not spill over into the service side of the economy. And I think getting a trade deal is very important right now, because we are seeing some cracks in the U.S. economy as a whole, and particularly in employment. You know, manufacturing employment has been really weak, and even the overall net non-farm payrolls on a month-to-month basis have been really decelerating over the past year. And one of the things that largely went unnoticed and untalked about was we recently got the revisions to the non-farm payrolls. And I believe, if not mistaken, it was for 2018 through May of 2019, if not mistaken. And they revised the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, revised down the number of jobs that were created by 500,000. That's 500,000 jobs that were overestimated. And you don't get revisions. Usually, you see big revisions at turning points. And that revision was the largest revision we had seen since 2009, at the depths of the great financial crisis and the biggest recession since the Great Depression. So we definitely have a lot of deceleration going on in terms of payrolls in the U.S. One of the things I keep an eye on is the Paychex market data. They track actual headcounts, and these are clients that Paychex has where they're getting the payroll data for the month. And what they do is they look at their data, come up with an index to figure out, okay, where are payrolls versus a year ago? And according to Paychex data, and this data never gets revised because this is actual headcounts, their data is showing that U.S. employment is down by 1%. And this is national. It's not just looking at manufacturing. Their data is showing that U.S. payrolls have fallen by 1%. That's not something you see outside of recession. It's typically something you see inside a recession. So my concern is that a lot of the data put out by the government that does get heavily revised, particularly at turning points, is showing that we're at a really vulnerable point right now, where some of the non-revised data is showing some clear signs of weakening. And so if we don't get some improvement on the manufacturing front, we could see continued spilling over of weakness in manufacturing into the service economy, and it could make the U.S. economy vulnerable heading into 2020 of a possible downturn, an actual recession, if we don't see a kind of turnaround. I think right now it's debatable whether we have a recession. I think we could have a touch and go where we decelerate to the point of almost slipping into recession, but then reaccelerate if we have positive fiscal policy, positive monetary policy, and even some positive global developments. And that's why a lot of these things that are going on right now, the Brexit, the trade deal, even U.S. monetary policy, if they're not understanding the true weakness and they're not cutting rates fast enough, it could be a very interesting and sensitive time in terms of determining, do we slip in a recession or do we actually pull out and have a sigh of relief as we did in 2016? And so that's why I think monitoring these developments will be so key to see, are we going to have a touch and go with the global economy and U.S. economy, or do we have the potential of slipping in a recession going into next year?
Well, you said the word, the V word, vulnerability, and in a Wall Street Journal economic survey recently conducted, 65.3% of private sector forecasters said the manufacturing sector was in recession. So it's going to be a really interesting thing to keep an eye on going forward. And because this is such a sensitive window of time, Chris, I'd like to bring you back to the studio in the next week or two where we can see, are we slipping more into the dark side or not as things unfold? So, Chris Poplava, thank you for joining us in the studio. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon. And in the meantime, we want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. On behalf of Chris Poplava and myself, we do want to wish all of you a great and happy weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.